Hi, everyone. Get ready for the 50th episode of The World Beyond. Podcast host Michael Mack and his Emotioneers of Tomorrow present some of the biggest highlights and guests. Sir Richard Taylor, Mate Rimac, Daniel Lamar, Dr. Alma Obama, Professor Patrick Glauner, Rolf Schumann, and many more. You ready? Let's jump right in.
The World Beyond. Michael Mack and his Emotioneers of Tomorrow. The Mack One Podcast.
I'm Mike Vermaak, and today I'm joined here in person at Studio 78 at Europa Park by a very unique guest, Mate Rimac.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Michael. It's really great to be here.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You've been, like myself, or I would say a rather average student in school, to build a world-renowned innovative company that partners with leading companies such as Porsche, Bugatti, Kia, Hyundai, BMW, and yourself have been celebrated and labeled the new Tesla. What an incredible journey. Do you sometimes pinch yourself? And how did you achieve all of that out of Croatia?
Oh man, I have so many pinch you moments. Like today I had several. Walking around with you around this roller coaster here that will bear the Nevera name. And you know, you are filming my story and you're going to tell it to many visitors here and to many kids. It's like, you know, many pinch you moments. But you know, the thing is, yes, if you look at it that way, it's like crazy, you know, where I was born, you know, in Bosnia in 1988, where there were basically no roads, you know, no cars almost. And donkeys were still very common. Like my family had donkeys and horses and cows, you know, at that time before the war started. And then, you know, just within one generation, I am, you know, often in skyscrapers in New York and Dubai, have meetings there. I drive 5 million euro cars. Often, you know, have to fly with private jets because I have no time to fly with normal. And so it's crazy what happened within one generation. I often cannot believe it. But, you know, that's like business, as you, Michael, know very well, is like constant solving of problems. Like you have sometimes literally fires you have to put out, both in your business and in my business, you know. There were many situations where you had literal fires, but also many different kinds of fires. Fires with, you know, customers, with finances, you know, with partners, with employees. You know, there's many, many problems. And the only thing I think about is my list of things to do. It's like thousands of items. And the problem is, no matter how much you work, the day is just too short to even scratch the surface of problems you have to deal with. And there is never time to lean back and say, wow, look at what I've done. I don't look at it that way. I don't look at it, you said success story. I look at it more like the odds, like the chances of being here where we are today from where we have started were like zero, like 0.000, you know, to come to this point. But I still don't consider it success because the company is still in the growth phase. We still raise money from investors. It's still not like, you know, if tomorrow I get run over by a truck, I'm not sure that the company would survive, which is not good. I don't want the company to depend on me. You know, the company is still fragile, you know. So I never say, okay, wow, I'm successful. We have reached success. And now, you know, let's praise ourselves with this great success. It's amazing that we are still around. It's amazing what we are doing. It's crazy. You know, I'm living my dream. But the normal day is dealing with lots of problems. So you don't have time to sit back, lean back, and say, wow, look at what you have done.
I'm beyond thrilled to welcome you here at Europa Park to my podcast, Sir Richard Taylor.
Thank you, Michael. It's lovely to be here.
Let me just reflect a little bit because you've been coming over from New Zealand, so we were maximizing our time together, and there was a late night last night, and we were talking about the center of detail and the center of all what we literally do in you and your company and here at Europa Park. And you were talking about the center of love. So if you maybe for our listeners could just retell the little thing we had about love and the center of creating things.
Yeah, for the listeners, I think if you're listening to this podcast, it's because you followed Michael, his father, the Europa Park story. And so I don't think that you'll find this corny or twee or a little bit sappy. I think you'll get this. But what I said to Michael last night, and it's a little used word these days. People are anxious or embarrassed or steer clear of using the word love. But love must be at the heart of the creative process. Without love at the heart, the audience can see it. Somehow the world in which you're inviting them into, whether that be film, TV, location-based experiences, or a theme park, in some way feels two-dimensional and superficial. I feel very strongly that it is beholden on people like Michael and his family and people like ourselves, practitioners of the creative process, where we are inviting people into our worlds to approach every task with a sense of unabashed enthusiasm and unfiltered love. And in turn, the audience are aware of it, and even if they wouldn't label it, and even if they chose to label it, may not speak it out loud, but I genuinely believe that when people come to Europa Park, and in a certain degree when people watch the films that we're fortunate to work on, they can sense the love of conviction to the craft, to the art, to the storytelling, to the connection that exudes through every pore of every person within the park, every crack in the pavement, every piece of theming in the experience. And that, to me, is the reason to celebrate in what we do, because to do anything less is to be wasting one's time, and you might as well just not get up in the morning. So let's keep love at the very center of everything that we do.
Today, my wonderful guest is Daniel Lamar. Thanks for coming, Daniel.
Thank you, Michael. It's an honor for me to have the opportunity to chat with you. Having visited your park, having visited your amazing, dinner experience, I cannot feel better and I cannot feel at home as I am talking with you.
I guess that everybody is knowing you and the company of Cirque du Soleil. I obviously am a huge fan. Can you talk a bit about where you came from and what is your position, your role in the company today?
Yeah, my background is first public relation. I was the owner of the largest public relation firm in Canada for 13 years. And then I received a phone call out of the blue from the founder of Guy Laliberté, the founder of Cirque du Soleil. And here I am, 20 years later, having the chance to travel the world with Cirque du Soleil.
Would you recommend to young people to get into this field and follow your path you've been doing over the years?
Yeah, I think it's, to me, it's the best industry in the world, because you have this amazing opportunity to entertain people, to bring them outside of their, normal life, have them go through emotion and laugh. And this is an amazing venture. And I certainly recommend it to someone. But whomever will join the industry, that person has to be very agile. That person has to be able to adapt to a lot of different situations on a day-to-day basis. But if you're adventurous enough to travel the world and gather people in your theaters, that's an amazing, amazing challenge.
Let's talk about trends in the development of live performances. At Cirque du Soleil, you have a trend group that travel around and identify trends. Can you tell us a little bit about that group and how many of those would be traveling around the world?
Yeah, we have scouts literally traveling around the world. We are in the lookout all the time. There is a few things that we're doing. First and foremost, we want to know everything about our industry. So this group will do a lot of what I call intelligence. So if you called me, Mike, and you say, there is a new show somewhere, I will go and I want to see it. For instance, that's why I went to visit you, because I wanted to have the opportunity to see your amazing dinner experience. Every time there is something new happening somewhere, we're going. Either I go myself or I send someone. We also spend a lot of time casting the best artists in the world. So if you call me today and you say, oh, I know this great artist, chances are that I will send a scout. And as we speak, in our data bank, we have over 300,000 artists. And we want to have la creme de la creme, as we say, in order to make sure that all the best artists in the world are performing for Cirque du Soleil.
Dr. Auma Obama, thank you so much for taking the time and coming to Studio 78 here at Europa Park.
Thank you so much for having me.
What does it mean to you to be an Obama? Does that name carry a significant part of your identity for you?
It definitely does. It's my name. For that reason alone, it's my name. And it's been my name all along since I was born. So that is my identity, my name. Well, first of all, it's an unusual name. We were the only Obamas in Kenya until people started naming their children after my brother. And also, it's a very important name to me because it's the name of my father, who I was very close to. So that keeps him alive for me. And also now, in the later periods, now it became prominent internationally, which has its problems as well, because you have a big responsibility with that name. And I hope that I'm doing the right thing for the name, and I'm using the opportunities it gives me to do the right thing. So it's really given me a tool to work with that I otherwise would not have had. So I really appreciate that. It's not always easy, to carry this mantle or this cloak that is the name, but so far, so good.
How do you stay so positive despite all the challenges in the world every single day?
I try to be realistic. That's the first thing. And I'm learning, and I've learned to not have such high expectations, because if you expect too much, it's very often that you get disappointed. So I think it's being realistic, staying grounded. And I think that's part of what you're trying to say about talking to your managers and saying, we have a service to each other, to people. So you have to interact with these people. And that is something that I think my father taught me. It's got to do also with humility. You know, even if you're leading, even if you're a manager, even if you're in a position of authority, you have to have humility. And I think I do have a good amount of humility, because I don't see myself as better than anybody else. So it helps me stay positive, because I know that the work I do it together with a lot of other people, and I wouldn't be able to do it on my own. So this not feeling that I have the pressure of achieving it on my own helps me stay positive. But I do have my bad days, I won't lie. I have my dark days when I think I cannot do it anymore, because the final responsibility is with me. And that's a very lonely space to be in when you're in charge and you call the shots at the end of the day.
Hmm. Do you think it really takes courage to get over yourself and to really approach people with an open heart?
I think now it's getting a bit more difficult because people are more closed. People are not so social that they used to be, where, you know people, it's a smaller community, you talk to each other. We've had situations where some of my young people in the foundation come to me and say, oh, I was walking on the street and I said good morning to this person, or I spoke to this person, and they kind of like bit my head off. Like, why am I talking to them? They don't know me. So people are getting more aggressive with each other. And maybe it's because of the economic pressures they have, and life is quite challenging nowadays. But it tends to make people intimidated and afraid to approach each other, to talk to each other. I'm still old school. I talk to everybody. I mean, with a bit of caution, of course, because nowadays with all of what is going on, like, for example, I remember when I lived in England, I would talk to young people, old people, children. And I was told once, you don't just talk to people like that, because if something happened to somebody and the last person who spoke to them, you could be in trouble. And this is like if a child falls down and you go and you help them get up. And I was really shocked. That was in the early days when I was living in Europe. And I said, how can we be so removed emotionally from each other? Because we are afraid that if we approach each other, we can end up being victimized. Mm-hmm. And that is really unfortunate. So I think it's important that we learn to be, maybe you don't even have to be kind, just respectful and mindful of each other. I think mindful is the right word.
Today, my guest is David Reinierson, Senior Software Program and Consultant at NASA.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
You're currently working on mapping the moon. What do we know about it? What are the most fascinating facts about it? Does the moon technically belong to anyone?
I think the most fascinating thing about the moon is that we actually really don't know much about the moon. You know, the last folks who went there were in 1972. That was the last time man set foot on the moon. And we can look at it and we can, you know, take samples from rovers and things like this, but it's not the same as actually going there and actually being there and being on the moon. So understanding the geological composition better might also give us better insights into how the Earth geological composition works, because at the moment, we only have the Earth really as a basis. We haven't used other objects as like to check our work and see like, does this match up? Does it function the same way? So that's, I mean, the most fascinating thing about the moon is that there is not as much as we'd like to know. And that's part of the reason why we were going there. And then on the question, does the moon technically belong to anyone? The answer is no. We have something called the Outer Space Treaty, and all spacefaring nations have adopted this treaty, which no nation can own anything in space. Any of the moons, planets, or stars, they can own the satellites, like countries can claim the satellites, but none of the celestial bodies are up for grabs. So anyone who's brave enough to go out there is free for all, so...
Staying in my world, like in the fictional world of theme park storytelling and technology, are there aliens out there? Do you believe in them?
I think this is the number one question I've gotten, is where are the aliens? Do they tell you that? They have not told me, so I cannot confirm or deny. You know, are there aliens out? Do I believe aliens are out there? Absolutely. Like, honestly, really, absolutely. It's a great waste of space otherwise, isn't it? There's just so much out there. It would be terrible. It's also, I mean, the people who doubt alien life, it feels a little egocentric to me to think that we are the only multicellular life, carbon life form that, you know, was able to get to the point of space flight. There's got to be others out there. I'm sure what form and what capabilities they will have, I think, is part of the, you know, the lovely mystery of the exploration. And I'm looking forward to meeting it, them, whatever it happens to be at some point. So
they don't appear actually on your map yet, because my son just asked me before going to bed. He said, like, you have on Google Maps, you have a 3D view. Can you ask the guy from NASA if he's seen any of them in his cameras? So you haven't seen them on the maps yet.
You know, I kept plugging them about that. I said, you know, if I'm going to work on this, you know, you really should send me to the moon so I can, you know, take some photos and get the 3D view going. I haven't heard anything back from that request. I'm sure it's in process.
Well, if you got a picture, just send it over to me so I can show it to my son.
And yes, tell him, of course.
First picture of alien from moon. Today, my very exciting guest is Professor Dr. Patrick Klauner.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
And as a professor and expert in AI, you've been consulted by various parliaments. Where do you see the biggest gap between political decision-making and understanding AI technologies?
Well, I think a lot of the politicians are driven by fears, and often a lot of these fears are purely theoretical. Obviously, there are also politicians who are very interested in AI and who know how it works, but that's definitely the minority. Most of them, I think they have a lot of opinion, but not much clue of how it actually works. And that's a problem if you have politicians claiming it's magic or out of control or unsafe. It isn't that. Eventually, it's mathematics and AI works and is safe.
But yet, there's a fear out there. So where does that fear come from? What is your take on that?
I think a lot of people are scared of AI because of the Terminator movies, which are purely science fiction, where there is an out-of-control AI eliminating humanity. But it isn't that in real. I think one thing that adds confusion to a lot of people is that a lot of the decision-making by AI is not really explainable. You have models, they make decisions, you can measure how good or how bad, but you cannot explain for a lot of these models why they make that decision. And I think that scares people. However, there's methodology to make certain models more explainable. Some models are explainable inherently, but I think we should not enforce double standards to AI compared to everything else in our life. A lot of things in our life are not really explainable, like development of new pharmaceuticals. You do clinical trials to see how good or how bad they perform, but even the developers cannot in detail explain why it works and how it works. They can just measure how good or how bad it is. And it's the same for a lot of AI, but in medicine, we're not scared about it. In AI, a lot of people are. And I think it's wrong to apply double standards in that case.
So no more Terminator movies then? So.
The Terminator, you know, it's science fiction. It's an illusion. I like the Terminator movies too, but they really have nothing, you know, that makes them real. And the Terminator will not happen in the foreseeable future.
Today, my very exciting guest is no one other than Kathy Hagel. Thank you for joining me today, Kathy.
Well, I am thrilled to be here.
It's just trying to overcome two prejudices, which some of our listeners might have, a woman in tech. Did you face any obstacles? So what was your first reaction from your colleagues being a tech geek, and how did you overcome them? And what would you recommend to other women to want to go into the tech and into this domain?
I think one of the things, be rebellious, be curious, continue learning. I think one of the things that set me up for success from an early age was that my my dad, who's a retired diplomat, both my mom and my dad raised me with no limits, in the sense that I have a brother, but they never said, you can't do this because you're a girl. They never said that. Like, I was always like, go get her. You can accomplish this. You can do this, right? So they didn't put limits on me because of being a female. So whenever someone says to me, you can't do that, or I don't think you can do that, I say, hold my beer. Let me go and do that. So for me, it's been like that. It's been rebellious. It's been challenging. It hasn't been always easy, 100% honest. You know, I've had to, you know, sometimes work two or three times as hard as some of my male counterparts. But now I've gotten to the point where things have gotten a lot, quote unquote, easier, more recognition. I still have my detractors. I still have my haters out there. But you know what? I don't let that slow me down. I continue building when it's hard to build, because my main mission in that is living my life like a lighthouse. I mean, I get a lot of like messages from a lot of women in technology, a lot of Latinas. I happen to be Latina. There's only 2% Latinas in technology. It's a minimal, like such small number. I get messages from women, from, you know, BIPOC people, from Latinas in tech saying, you're inspiring me. So it doesn't matter if I get some hate along the way, because I am that lighthouse. I am opening up that road and that path for people to come behind me and be even more successful. So yeah, it's hard, but I do it gladly. I do it, and I gladly, you know, do the things I do, because I do believe that I'm opening and blazing a trail for more people.
So if you would sum it up in one question, is it just be stubborn enough and to fight for your goals and your dreams? Or what would be
be determined. I don't think stubborn's the right word. I think be determined. Okay. Try your darn hardest to accomplish what you want to accomplish. You might fail. You know, we all fail at times. We all fall off. But yeah, I think the main motivators are that, like, being determined and also knowing that you're part of a bigger plan and that what you do matters. You don't even know who's seeing you, right? There are people that that might think no one's watching what I'm doing, but there might be someone at home. There might be someone in their neighborhood. There might be someone on social. There might be someone in the business world that says, wow, I want to be able to do what they're doing. I know, you know, and that it's by leading by example.
I'm thrilled to introduce a truly exceptional guest, Thor Pedersen.
Well, thank you so much.
I stumbled over reading about your story that you never took an airplane. I mean, what inspired you of not taking an airplane, or why did you take that decision?
It came about in early 2013 when my father sent me an email, and there was a link about extreme travelers. And I started diving into that world, and I discovered that nobody in history had gone to every country completely without flying. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that we were in 2013 with so many travel happy people, and that there was still something of that magnitude that had not been done. For many years, I grew up feeling like everything has been done. They've been to the highest mountains, the deepest seas. They went to the moon. I mean, what is left for the rest of us? But nobody had done it in 2013. So I didn't think I was going to do it, but you can say I was infected almost. And I started talking to friends and family, and nobody had the same interest in it as I had. But it kept growing, and I started just playing with the idea, not saying that I was going to do it, but just if I was going to do it, how would I do it? Which way would I go? East, west, north, south? And what would I pack? And how long would it take? And what kind of budget and all of this? And suddenly I realized that I was so invested, I had to do it.
So you didn't have any, you were literally fearless of doing that trip.
No, it's a big world. Don't let anyone tell you anything else. It's a very, very big world. And there's a lot in this world. And like many other people, I follow the news, and media has a tendency to tell us the worst of the worst stories. And we hear these stories from morning to evening and all week long and all year around. So I knew that it was risky business. I had trust in that most of the world and most of the people I would meet would be ordinary people and it would be calm. But I also knew that there would be risk involved. And I knew I would have to go to countries that had active war zones or conflict areas. And I knew that there would be disease out there. And I knew that some of the transportation I would have to rely on would be doubtful at best. So I didn't leave home thinking that I had 100% success rate of coming back home alive. But of course, I was hoping.
My name is Marcus. And here with me today, just arrived straight from Madrid, is Jelle de Jong. Jelle, welcome to the podcast. I'm really so happy to finally meet you here in person.
Yeah, I'm happy to be back.
Some critics argue that immersive exhibitions, with their heavy reliance on technology, could somewhat overshadow the importance of traditional art and traditional exhibitions. So how would you respond to this criticism? And do immersive exhibitions enhance or diminish our appreciation of art and culture?
Well, I think it shouldn't be seen so black and white. I think those things couldn't exist very good right beside each other. I don't see the regular exhibition of real paintings to be dissolving in the future. Yep. The interest for that kind of exhibits will always stay there. And at the same time, the immersive exhibitions are growing and trying to open new doors and walk new paths. And I really think the way it exists next to each other is perfect. Sometimes they reach out and go very much hand to hand. I mean, there was a lot of critics from the old-fashioned, so to say, musea. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, last week, even the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam is doing a metaverse in front of the Nightwatch. True. In their big gallery. So I think there's no way back. It was the same when television started. It was the same when the streamers came. It was the same when the social media came. So all these things, people have to get used to it. They're maybe frightened a bit in the beginning. They don't know what to expect. I mean, I had it very much a few years ago with VR. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't in love with it. I wasn't seeing all the possibilities it would give us. Yep. And now I'm working with it daily and really enjoying it and seeing how our audience enjoys it from 6 years old to 106. So we're moving, we're exploring, we're learning. Mm-hmm. And maybe there are some downsides which will be clearer to see in 2 or 3 years. Yep. And those will dissolve by itself. I mean, it will always be balanced out in the end. Mm-hmm. And if something is not accepted or not well, yeah, going hand in hand with the demand of the audience, mm-hmm. at some point it just disappears. Exactly. So I'm not afraid of that. Yeah. Critic, because also the critics themselves change their opinions.
Right. Especially in immersive entertainment and especially in the field of innovation, it is like the holy grail is to find the exact right spot of what is maximum advanced yet accepted. Would you agree? So you need to bring your audience from something that they know to something that they do not yet know. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think we should be creative and try new things and see what is the maximum balance of what we can do with has surprising audiences truly, but we must be careful that we don't become too abstract or too artistically moving to something so innovative that my audience is disappointed in the moment they see the show.
Right.
In that case, I would say we have to be some kind of conservative while we try new things, but maybe those new things are being tried under the table or out of sight of the audience. Mm-hmm. And then we bring that on later in a few years, maybe when the audience is truly ready for something that is even more innovating. But we take it step by step. I mean, we already went from just an immersive, just projection to a seated VR. Now people are free roaming around while they have the VR goggles. Mm-hmm. The next step is the implementation of the smell and the 5D, I mean, what's being used here right across the street in the 4D cinema, the 5D cinema. So every year we tend to innovate. And I think that is also something great that people walk out and they say, hey, it was again, one step further than last year. And again, something new happened. And they keep talking about it. And they keep saying, hey, you should go and experience one of the shows of Mott in our case.
Today, my guest is Athena Demas.
Hello, thank you. Wonderful to be here.
So you've created the much celebrated and multi-award winning virtual Burning Man experience. Can you describe it to us in a few words?
BRCVR, which stands for Black Rock City Virtual Reality, BRCVR was one of the official virtual Burning Man experiences. And what we created was both a social, a collaborative, and a educational system for helping people create their art and share it and then connect with others. And this is unprecedented in the VR space. We had over 200 worlds, 100 of which we created, 100 of which the community created, and we had 3,500 hours of programming over an 8-day period of time. There's only 192 hours in 8 days. So that's a lot to do and see. All the worlds were interconnected to each other so that you could hop from one to another. And we were told that what we created was basically a metaverse. But I feel like these have already existed, just much smaller than what we did. And we got a lot of press and a lot of awards, which brings a lot of attention. But I was able to personally connect with people in China and Kenya, Uruguay, Argentina, Peru, Mexico, all over the United States, all over Europe. We had a huge community from Spain and Italy that were all hanging out. And it's difficult for people to get to Burning Man. The event itself is in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the United, like the upper quarter of the United States. It's very expensive to get to. It's very difficult to get to. It takes a lot of planning and not everyone can make it. But the number one reason why people go to Burning Man is to connect with community. So if you want to connect with community, then what we created with BRCVR makes that accessible. It makes your ability to connect with community that's creative, that are artists that want to collaborate with you. BRCVR allowed for that to happen, and that's why we had such a huge response. Educationally, we did Zoom calls to show people the resources of how to build in Blender, how to assemble your world in Unity and upload it onto the platform. Sometimes it was just onboarding calls to teach people how to get on the platform. And we learned a lot about event production because that is my background. And I had to figure out how to do event production in VR and what we did that was so different.
What are your goals with the platform and how do you believe it will evolve in the future?
We're in the middle of a massive evolution right now. BRCVR originally was built on the Altspace VR platform. So Doug and I and a few other people have decided that we're going to build our own. We're going to build a place for BRCVR to live. And then ultimately, the tool sets that we create will be adaptable to hopefully to other platforms. But also if people want to use the methodology that we create to build their own corner of the metaverse, they can. So it'll be pick the little modules, and put them together and create your own metaverse for your brand, for your community, for your theme park, for whatever you want. So that is what we're working on and building, and we're using our experience and the needs of the creator community to create it.
Welcome to my guest, Rolf Schumann.
Thank you for having me.
Give us a brief insight. Who is the Schwarz Group and what do you do?
First of all, the Schwarz Group is not so well known, as you said before. We are Europe's largest retailer. What does it mean? You all know the brands Lidl and Kaufland. So we are a classical retailer, Europe's number one, worldwide number four. And it's a huge group. So we have roughly 575,000 employees, about 14,000 stores. And this is what people know us for. What they do not know, and this is this huge ecosystem. It is an ecosystem because, as I said before, the special thing about the Schwarz Group is we have our own food production, which means we are producing 50,000 tons of chocolate a year. This means 2,000 bars a minute, so 24/7. I think 1.4 billion ice creams. We have waters, 3.6 billion bottles of water, bake-off. We have this whole coffee factory. So when you see, look at this, you say, okay, they are a retailer, they also produce the food, but at the end of the day, we are thinking in circular business, which means we also have a total waste management and recycling company. So this means we really live this idea of circular business. And it's not only about selling the food, producing the food, recycling the whole waste, it's also that we go fully digital. So of course we have digital channels, so we have an online shop for Lidl, we have our marketplace for Kaufland. And now you understand why this company is so fancy, because it's a completely end-to-end connected ecosystem from manufacturing to sales, online, offline, as well the whole recycling. And what I'm, I would say, extremely proud is our water bottle. You know, when you're the largest water source in Germany and you produce 3.6 billion bottles and you know that the bottle is 100% recycling, so the bottle becomes a bottle, becomes a bottle, then you understand that I call it the beauty of this kind of company.
If I put two and two together, what is your end aim? Do you want to get the European Amazon? Or, I mean, where does it all end?
We do not want to become the European Amazon. I think the key thing is what we do is, whatever we do, you won't get at Amazon, you won't get at Microsoft, you won't get at Google. So what we do is we try to offer and build sovereign digital services. What we want to become is, at least we want to have a contribution that in Europe, companies or individuals can leverage and run digital services in their control to keep up their sovereignty. This is the key difference. We want to make sure that digital, which is so essential for the people, is in a position with services that you are independent on the one hand side and sovereign, that the mindset, the values is similar to how you build your corporate values. And this is what we do. So everything we have built is because we didn't find this in the market. If we would find cybersecurity services which are sovereign and end-to-end thinking, we would have bought them, because we never do a me too or just for the sake of cyber. Whatever we do is we come to the point that we said this service is so crucial for a company, especially for us, that we want to make sure it lays in our hands based on our values, how we base on our laws, and because it is so needed. We cannot give this into the hands of others, but we have the feeling that our core business will be harmed over time. So this is the reason why I'm saying we will continue on the game to say Schwarz Digits and the Schwarz Group will continue to deliver sovereign digital services, what you need to run your company. And this is a complete unique and a USP. And this is why we have so much fun.
Today, my very exciting guest is Mike Zuckery. Thanks for coming, Mike.
It's my pleasure, Michael. I love your podcast and I'm delighted to be part of it.
With pandemics and great digital at home entertainment options on the rise, it is not perhaps outdated to be laying so much focus on location-based entertainment.
Well, as we know, many people did a great job of staying entertained during the pandemic, whether it was playing video games or getting a VR headset, baking bread, buying an exercise bike, or getting a big TV and watching streaming services. But these kinds of activities at home have a limited impact on our happiness. During the pandemic, 50% of people were suffering from depression or anxiety,
in part because people really needed to connect with their friends and family. And fortunately, technology allowed us to do through Zoom, VR, and other means. During that time, I even organized online reunions of friends and classmates from all over the world, which was so meaningful to the participants and never could have happened in person. But it turns out that being out in the community and connecting to our tribe is not only fun, but it's also vital to our mental health and well-being. In the end, we are all really social creatures, and as soon as we could get out of our homes, people returned to theme parks and other location-based entertainment in record numbers, as I know you experienced at Europa Park.
When looking at your CV and your areas of expertise, one can't help but notice how exciting and diverse it is. Film and television, home entertainment, mobile and online, then working for Disney. Can you walk us through your life until now and explain how all of these amazing things happen to you?
Well, I have loved entertainment my entire life. My earliest memory is going to Walt Disney World as a small child. And a few years later, my family moved to California, and the first things we did were to go to Universal Studios and Disneyland. In college, I loved live music and theater, so I adapted Pink Floyd The Wall into a rock opera and directed it for the stage. I also studied Italian, and when I graduated, the largest entertainment company in Italy had just started making movies in the U.S. So I interviewed there, was hired, and it became a 13-year career in the international film and TV business. I then worked for a large home entertainment retailer called Columbia House and for startups in the mobile and online content space, largely licensing video, music, and more from major rights holders. But in 2011, I joined Disney doing business development for consumer products, digital projects, and live shows with IP ranging from the classic characters like Mickey Mouse to the Muppets and Star Wars. But working at Disney reminded me that what I really loved was theme parks and location-based entertainment. I also had a young son at home who loved roller coasters and wanted to ride the best ones around the world. So in 2017, I moved to 20th Century Fox to run their themed entertainment division. And as luck would have it, Disney announced 3 months later they were going to buy Fox. So I was back at Disney shortly thereafter.
Mac One presents The World Beyond. Brought to you by Michael Mack and his Emotion Ears of Tomorrow.